Welcome back to the Compass live stream. A couple streams ago, I got muted right off the get-go and was afraid that was going to happen again. Anyway, happy Friday. We are pumped to be back streaming with two amazing guests on the best and also the only live stream dedicated to proof of work mining. Pretty easy streaming competition here. Austin and Bob are two miners. I'm going to let them give their introductions in just a minute. Before we get into the conversation, though, and intros and everything, I want to give a huge shout out to all the Bitcoin miners in Denver who came out last night. We Compass hosted a happy hour, and it was a ton of fun. For some of us, a little too much fun. Can definitely feel it today. But Denver has an awesome Bitcoin crowd. If you notice, I don't have my regular setup, background and whatnot. I'm actually in Denver with Will, meeting some of these guys and girls. It was awesome. So thank y'all for coming out. Enough about Denver, though. We're here to talk about hash rate. The topic for today's stream is basically how long until we can expect Bitcoin's hash rate to make a full recovery and, you know, keep going up and to the right on that chart. Bob from Barefoot Mining and Austin from Great American Mining are two people that Will and I both have an immense amount of respect for. They both know a lot about mining. I mean, everyone on this show does. But I'm going to let them now give first Bob to you and then Austin introductions on, you know, how you guys got into mining, where sort of you came from before mining and what each of you are working on at Barefoot and at GAM. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Well, thanks, Zach. Thanks, Will. Really a pleasure to be on here today. So as you probably tell, I'm one of the probably the older guys in the industry. And my background's always been in technology. So goes back to 1986. I was a electrical engineer, computer science guy coming out of college and worked on what was arguably the first laptop computer in 1986, kind of as my first project in school. And for those of you that are maybe a little older, eventually that wound me through to a company called Gateway, which was a large personal computer company in the 90s and 2000s, where I was a chief technology officer there. So I led all the product development, laptops, desktops, et cetera. So it was an exciting time, kind of through the personal computer industry and the internet. And to be honest, I kind of thought like, man, I've had a great ride. I've been through two major waves of technology and not necessarily riding off into the sunset, but, you know, not expecting that there was something going to be equally or greater in excitement ever crossing my path again. And then, in 2017, is when I entered mining, and I entered mining in a funny way where I got a phone call from an acquaintance who said, "Hey Bob, can you design me an Ethereum mining machine?" My knowledge at that point was pretty limited. I didn't understand why he wanted that. So I dug in, make a long story short. He wanted to buy several hundred of these. I had an old relationship with NVIDIA. I'm another member of my team. So we had access to the chips, which were hard to get at the time. And we built several hundred machines for him. And I thought, wow, I'm back in the computer business again. And slowly that led to, I started asking other people, "Hey, would you like one too?" And surprisingly, a number of people said yes, but a lot of them said yes, but only if you'll host it for me. So I ended up in hosting, and then I saw how much money people were making. So I said, well, I better start taking some of these profits and put them back into machines for myself. So I started mining for our company. And we still, by the way, do all those things. I ended up, though, like a lot of people do, ended up as, you know, started in Ethereum, found my religion in Bitcoin a little while later. And we still have the Ethereum mining operations, but sidetrack me for another time is we use all that to generate Bitcoin. So we're,
gotcha.
You know.
It's interesting how many miners, you know, Bitcoin miners currently started out as Ethereum miners. I'm finding more and more of them every week. It's some of it's surprising. Some of it makes perfect sense, but it's definitely interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, so anyway, we ended up becoming a U.S. distributor for a company called Bitfury, which is a larger European-based ASIC company. And now what we do kind of going forward is we're very Bitcoin-focused. We've become focused on what I call boutique mining, which means, you know, we primarily are mining for ourselves or investors that we bring in. You know, we like to focus on operations in size of like 1 to 3 to 5 megawatts. So we're not doing big, big installations, but maybe we'll talk about it later. I think it's an important part of the Bitcoin for sure. infrastructure. And my vision is, I like to say it's like dandelions. You know, I want to be the dandelions of the ecosystem. And there'd be sure. so many of these sites in that size range. And it might even be smaller, it might be 300 kilowatts or 500 kilowatts or 2 megawatts. But I think, you know, a world populated with those, I think creates an indestructible, very reliable network. And so outside of the economic piece, in terms of, you know, what I want to contribute to the ecosystem, that's kind of, I feel, the role we're playing.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a beautiful strategy. I agree 100% with the as much distribution of mining as possible. Austin, great to have you on the show. We just had you before we started the live stream. We had you on the audio only podcast version a bit ago. Always love chatting with you. Can you, you know, give us the quick and dirty rundown of for people who may not know what you're working on, how you got into mining and how you got into GAM more specifically?
Yeah, so quick, dirty rundown. Started doing some Ethereum GPU mining in like 2016. Started building the container builds in 2017 and 2018 with the first company that I founded called Bearbox. And then Great American Mining, who I currently work for, and I'm technically my title is Director of Engineering. I build all of our containerized infrastructure and design the electrical distribution systems, and then also write the software that kind of makes the magic work. We primarily focus on flare gas in the Bakken, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Texas, a couple other places. And yeah, same thing, you know, the boutique mining model, if you call it that, in that 1 to 5 megawatt range of deployments is kind of where we're cutting our teeth. And it's pretty interesting stuff, especially given the current economics, right? And so, yeah, I mean, we, like, kind of one of the things at GAM, we design and build everything in-house, which is a little bit different than some other folks have done. And so it's an all-day, every-day endeavor to keep track on production supply lines and all the supply chains that we're currently going under. I think that's what we're talking about on this podcast, right? Or this live stream. So
yeah, for sure. I think that we got really two interesting aspects here for this, or two interesting point of views for this stream. And we're talking about like hash rate and why hash rate rebounded the way it did. So we're hovering around like 123 exahash, I think, is what we saw earlier. We might have a chart somewhere we can throw up as well. And it's surprising to see like that hash rate came up. Zach had a bet earlier in the year. I forget, it was on Twitter. He said like, we use stakes.
True.
Was it over 150 or under 150?
I forgot about that, actually. Yeah, I might be in some hot water here. So I made a bet we won't be over 150 before the end of the year, basically.
And we're at one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's surprising to see that hash rate, like, you're seeing that V come right back up as people are incentivized to get more miners onto the network. And so I guess just to start off, Austin, are you surprised to see this hash rate rebound so quickly? And then Bob will move over to you and kind of work through your recent article.
No, I'm not. I mean, like, if you've got visibility into some of the larger orders that were placed by these larger institutional North American miners, like, the hash rate that's coming online right now isn't the same hash rate that left China, right? These are orders that were placed a year ago that are now being delivered for facilities that started builds a year ago, and they're just now being racked and lit. And so when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, you know, extra 20 exahash in the last month or two. Nothing crazy. Like, that's all stuff that was already planning on coming online and already ordered and already had infrastructure for it. It's just the exodus of miners from China and finding rack space for those guys. Like, that's not coming online before the end of the year, or a small minority of it will. So
now, Bob, same question to you. Are you surprised to see the hash rate rebounding so quickly over the last few months? I mean, it's been it was late June when the edict kind of came out, and here we are in August and seeing a decent amount of hash rate come back.
Slightly surprised by the magnitude, certainly not the direction, but maybe slightly surprised by the magnitude. But I think, I'm on the whole in alignment with Austin on this one. I think it's important to remember, Austin kind of alluded to it. There's kind of four categories of hash out there. Okay. There's the old, Chinese infrastructure that got decommissioned. There is the Chinese infrastructure that was on order and planned because they had orders, right? They had a big queue going. And then there was the existing, primarily North American and European infrastructure that existed. And then there's the planned infrastructure for those groups. So I think there's four different kind of groups kind of working in tandem. And as Austin said, I mean, I've got a small facility coming up in South Carolina that I'll be up next week as we basically are flipping the switch. And, you know, we've been working for a long time on that. I know Austin's got projects he's been working on and all over, you know, we've been working for months to create this stuff. So when we see the hash rate recover, Austin put it really well. The hash rate coming back is largely not the Chinese. The caveat I'll throw, and there's no way to prove it, is I do think a little bit more of the Chinese infrastructure ended up heading to Kazakhstan and Georgia and, you know, some of those Eastern European locations than I would have expected. I only know that, you know, I'm only surmising that from conversations I've had from other people. Obviously, we can't tell. So I think a little bit more of that came online. Some of the Chinese folks that I've talked to are very nervous about it. They're nervous about jurisdictional issues, which I'm sure we'll touch on at some point here. You know, where do you go? But there's some desperation as well that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they lost everything. I mean, it's tragic, really.
It's, quick call up for you, Bob, there. So Vincent Vong, who's our procurement officer at Compass, he's on a Twitter space with us the other day. He's talking about how there's a lot of Chinese miners are holding their next gen equipment in storage instead of sending it over to the US. Or, I mean, they obviously they're having a hard time finding stuff, but they're not liquidating. And they're also just like not moving it quite yet because it's also like prohibitively expensive to ship stuff right now. And so that is like a play that ASIC prices will continue to go up. And we're seeing that kind of affect the ASIC market right now in May and June when everyone saw this edict come out. They thought ASIC prices are going to tank because there's going to be a lot of liquidations. That kind of happened for like a second, but not really. We've seen ASIC prices still be really high. So wondering what you've heard about that from your contacts. Maybe also if you have some thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, so I think a couple of things, right? The ASIC supply chain right now is just totally borked. I mean, you can look at the secondary markets, you can look at the primary markets, you can look at the number of contracts that have been canceled with like down payments or deposits that are just never going to be recovered. I think it's a lot worse than a lot of people who are kind of fleeing China are alluding to. And my personal thesis is there's like a cabal of miners with this huge oversupply of ASICs that they can't find capacity to plug in, but they're slowly dripping them into the market to not crash the price so they can recover some of the capital, which, I mean, is what I would do, frankly. And so I think it's a little bit manipulated, number one. Number two, shipping prices like freight from China right now, I think the last quote that I saw was like 24 grand for a 20-foot standard ISO, which is insane. Last year there were 10 grand, which was still insane. Before that, it was like 4,500, 5 grand. And even the container prices that like we see locally for new one-time use, like 20-foot standard or 40-foot standard, have gone up almost 250 to 300% since the last year, right? And so the supply chains all over the world are, as Marty likes to say, just borked out of control, right? And I don't think it's going to recover anytime soon. And so like we buy a significant amount of electrical components and supply from some of the largest manufacturers in the country. And we're already getting like pushed lead times on things that previously I could see turnaround in, you know, 21 days or 28 days. And now it's 35, 42, 49, indefinite. As all of that continues to unfold, as these, you know, call them like small tyrant authoritarian jurisdictions begin locking people down again, we'll start to see even bigger slowdowns. And so it's an interesting problem on the infrastructure side, like in terms of not only like how fast can you build transformers, but how fast can you source the components for those transformers? What does your labor market look like for the people who are going to build them? And there's a lot of stuff that is going to complicate all this hash rate coming back online for sure.
Yeah, we're trying to get an image up of that really quick. That chart showing the prices for containers is just like astronomical, parabolic, which is wild. Bob, what about from your context and people you've seen? Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, a couple things. One thing I forgot to mention about the hash rate recovery is I have a suspicion that I cannot validate it, that some of the larger Chinese miners knew it was coming. I've talked to some that have a lot of mining capacity, and they already, this is even goes back to Disrupt, for those of you who are at, you know, Disrupt in July, they already had stuff in the US in containers looking for a home. So if you do the math on that, to what Austin said, you know, it's hard to get a container, they're expensive, it takes a long time to decommission a unit. So I think some of that hash, I think they found some homes for some of that. So some of that hash came back a little quicker. I have had some offers from some of them to buy some of the older stuff. This is like pre-S9 generation stuff. I was a little surprised it was even in play, but there was a fair amount of that sort of stuff. And I think we've seen that in the market. But everything else, as Austin said, I said, well, I don't want to buy any of that stuff, but you know, will you sell me some S19s or 17s or, you know, other things? And they are still hoping to find homes for those. I'm not sure where. I know we're going to cover that in a little bit, but so they're still holding, as you said, Austin. And I think part of it too is that they don't want to flood the market. But the new stuff is pretty expensive too. The spot market, especially for that new stuff, is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's spot market. So there's a lot of stuff I want to touch on there. Spot market, though, really quick. It's kind of interesting. You see spot ASICs priced above futures or future deployments, which, you know, doesn't happen too often. But I think, backing up just a minute, I think the breakdown, Bob, you gave and Austin corroborated of, you know, the demographics, I guess, basically of what type of hash is coming online, what hash has disappeared, and where it's sort of sitting was beautiful. Because, you know, we've seen this rebound. We're above 120 exahash. I might have to be buying somebody stakes on Twitter in a couple months. But it's not Chinese hash that's coming back online. Like they are, I forget who used the word, but they're desperate. And we've talked about this on a couple of previous live streams. They're not used to, like, the North American mining market is very different from the Asian mining market in terms of contracts that are set, how revenue is shared and profits are distributed, that sort of stuff. And not only was this sort of like a last minute for most miners, I agree with Bob, like some of these miners had to have known something was coming, like just from the way Chinese industry works in many cases, they probably had some sort of inkling or a slight heads up, but they're desperate and shipping is expensive and they don't want to flood the markets if they can't find space. Everyone's trying to find space. And there's this huge glut of hardware. So I don't know if I want to throw around the word, you know, like manipulated too much, but I mean, there's definitely that vibe for sure, where a lot of these ASICs are sitting there in storage. And you know, some of these miners probably know in the back of their minds, like they're just not going to find rack space for all of them, but they don't want to just go market sell them in a week and tank prices. So it's a little bit of a tricky line to walk there. I don't know. Any other thoughts on, I did want to touch, we basically already covered it, but I did want to touch on sort of the breakdown of what type of hash rate is coming online. Any other thoughts before we move on to looking at a little bit of the research and analysis Bob has done? Any other thoughts on like what type of hash is coming online? What type of hash is prevented from being put back online now, and sort of when, if or when those Chinese miners are going to catch a break and be able to fully power on all their machines again. Austin or Bob, either one.
I'll just state the obvious that if you've got a bunch of equipment on the sidelines, you're gonna put your most efficient stuff in play first, right? So as you find the energy, find a spot, regardless of where it is, you're gonna put your best stuff in place first, right? And so as you follow that through, what you end up realizing is that the oldest stuff is gonna come online last. And by the time it comes on, it probably doesn't have the right economics. And so, I know we're going to talk about the paper I wrote, but I mean, roughly my estimate was at least 20% of this will never see the light of day again, you know, and that would include most, I think, of the S9 class stuff that's in China now will never see the light of day again.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we can jump into it here in just a minute, your analysis, but you obviously want the newer machines online sooner because you have like higher ticket hardware to ROI on. Then you have, like, as you go down the tiers, just an army of old ASICs, a lot of which is in storage people are trying to find space for. And I mean, if we're looking at, you know, $500,000, $1 million Bitcoin, those machines can be pretty profitable. I think, like, for your S9, you need anything lower than like 14 cent power, I think, to be profitable. There are a lot of machines that probably won't be back online anytime soon. But let's talk some numbers really briefly here. One of the reasons I wanted Bob on the show is not just because he's a cool guy and has a great Twitter handle, Boomer_BTC, but he also wrote some analysis on basically, well, like the topic of the show, when we can expect hash rate to sort of recover. Based on, you know, past difficulty cycles, average growth in hash rate historically, we're really having struggles here with our with our screen sharing for images and stuff. But Bob, can you, while we're sorting this out on the back end, can you just give us a high level overview on, you know, the topic of your paper and research, and what got you started, basically the model you built?
Yeah. So what I did is I said, well, there's first, how many machines are there? What's the magnitude of the situation? So and it's in the article that Zach's referring to, but I calculated there are roughly 2 million ASICs that were in China that were going to be decommissioned. So, give or take, probably 10%, that number's accurate. And if I'm inaccurate, by the way, I'm probably low. It probably would be to the higher side that I was wrong if I was wrong. But then I started digging deeper because, I run a mining company. It's what I do. And I said, you know, what is the impact of this? And so my thought wandered to block times. And so I'll tell you the impetus for it. We'll come back to it later. But for those of you less, driven on a day-to-day basis by mining revenue, there's kind of a standard calculation people use, which is 144 blocks a day, right? Because it's the simple math of 10-minute block times how many 10-minute segments in a day. But if we're running faster than that, that means more blocks, and that means more miner revenue. Without any additional operating cost, right? Because we all have the same operating cost regardless of how many blocks get mined per day. So if that number goes up, our revenue goes up and this thing gets even better, right? We're a bigger, let's say a 1 megawatt operation on one day, you're a certain percentage of the world's hash power. And the next day you're you're a little bit higher. But then if the block times are faster too, then that's additive. So I was curious and I went down into the rabbit hole because of that. That was the impetus of it. So what I did was the chart that's up now is I said, well, let me divide the world into the China hash rate coming back online and the rest of the world and its plans to already recover. Now, you can see already that I undershot this in this estimate. This was done in mid-July. So for people's reference, and I will do a re, I will redo it at some point. Well, I'll put it up publicly, you know, maybe based on the latest difficulty adjustment, but directionally it's still correct. And so you can see here that basically what's happening is I'm saying, you know, how many units practically could come back online? And that's in large part due to, you know, how many locations do I think they are? How much labor is involved in putting something back online? You know, a lot of those sort of factors. I also went back, I hadn't actually done it before, but I was curious to see what the average for hash rate coming back online, each difficulty adjustment. So it works out to be about, over the last 3 years, about 2.25 exahashes per second per difficulty adjustment. So that's basically the average. And so, I saw that accelerating. So I built that in and you can see the rate of the acceleration here, because it starts compounding, right? There's a, yeah. There's a compound effect of that. So it starts accelerating. So I divide it by difficulty adjustment epochs. So that's what that means if you're looking at it. So the epoch 345 was the one that started after the July 31st adjustment. And if you flow this one through, that would take you through July of next year, if I'm approximately right. So this is roughly a 1 year look at the situation.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And I think, I mean, initially I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on whether you're surprised we're sitting at 120 exahash, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, just because like I'm a little surprised that it's rebounded, you know, about, what is it, like 20-30% off of the local bottom for hash. But like this model to me, like when I first read it, and we first started chatting on Twitter, it makes a lot of sense to me. I think the timeline is pretty accurate, but we may definitely see it recover a little bit faster than we expect. That sort of recovery though, like we talked about a minute ago, is coming from very different hash power that was taken offline in the first place. More brand new hash power coming from North America, parts of Latin America, Eastern Europe, that sort of stuff. This is really cool data. I appreciate the research you did. Bob, for everyone watching, the article is called Wayward Block Times and Their Impact on Bitcoin Mining. It's on Medium. It's all over Twitter, been shared a bunch. Definitely go read through it and check it out. I don't know, Austin, you and I have talked about hash rate recovery, like directionally speaking, I guess, with Bob's data. Do you, like, what are your thoughts? Do you agree with it directionally? Do you think it's a little bit overblown in terms of the time expected for recovery? I know you also are expecting sort of a prolonged period of time before we see, you know, hash rate back to new all-time highs. What are your thoughts?
Yes. Yeah, so I was looking for one of the models that we have internally, and I'm not projecting that we reach like 250 exahash on network until, I don't know, November of next year, somewhere in that range, right? And yeah. that's just from like my understanding of what the current production rate is on the miners and what some of these contracts I've seen for larger scale folks coming into the US and the North American markets. China, you know, and that entire band kind of threw a wrench in that model. But at the same time, you know, I look at the amount of skilled labor and just flat out materials that you need to put that hash rate in Kazakhstan or in Georgia or in, you know, South America, or I mean, wherever. It's not an easy undertaking. And I mean, look, even here, like, I don't think ERCOT does substation tie-ins until like October. And so any of the new hash rate that's like planning in any of these big mega facilities in West Texas, none of that's coming on until October of next year. And so we've got, you know, not in addition to material and supply chain issues, you've also got labor shortage issues, and you also just have timing issues and in terms of when these big substations can tie in. So off-grid, like what we do, it's a little bit more like we're able to elastically expand given a few variables around air emissions, but it's it's not going to happen as fast as people think. What we have coming on right now and what we'll have coming on for the next 6 to 8 months were projects that were started 12 months ago. That's it.
Interesting.
Just because people didn't know about them doesn't mean they don't exist, right? Like, just because it wasn't built into your model doesn't mean there's not like a 200 megawatt facility in West Texas that's coming online this October that was planned and built, like started built like last year. And so I think the majority of that stuff will be next October, where we'll just see just an explosion of hash rate. But in the meantime, it's kind of dink and dunk here and there for, you know, 25 megawatts, 50 megawatts and below.
Just to follow up there really quick. Go ahead, Bob.
I was just going to say, I'm in violent agreement, but I just pulled my numbers back up. And so I think Austin and I, in terms of when we reach 250, we're within about probably 4 weeks of each other in terms of our estimates. So we may have pulled forward a little bit this first part, but it'll adjust back, and something on the order of that table that we put up a few minutes ago is going to happen.
Some nice confluence there. That's a good sign.
So really quick, between Austin and Bob, want to get your thoughts on like where this exahash is coming from in terms of facilities, and then what you guys think going forward, because we bottomed to like 90 exahash, I think was kind of like the bottom of hash right there, and now it's like up to 120. I'm wondering, have you guys seen, it's just, you said dink and dunk and parts of like some facilities with a few megawatts, you've seen things like Wineso come online with tons of megawatts. So far, has like the last 30, 40 exahash that's come online, has that mostly been like one certain type of facility? And then going forward, do you expect it to be like a mix of off-grid and like medium-sized facilities? Or do you see like these larger facilities like Winestone kind of dominating the market going forward?
That's an interesting question. So I think both, right? I think if you can get the economics, like obviously there's advantages to doing things at scale, like the Winstone facility or any of the other West Texas developments that, you know, they're subsidized in a small way by having 100,000 square foot footprint, where they, you know, fall into the sales tax exemption. There are some demand response programs within ERCOT that allow them to, you know, take advantage of some pretty decent pricing, depending on the term of the PPA or, you know, power option agreement, whatever you want to do. And so I think that long term, you know, I'm very bullish on Texas and these larger grid builds. I wish the incentives weren't aligned around some of the renewable like production tax credits and investment tax credits that the federal government gives for the power generators, but that's not a thing that I can solve. At the same time, some of your like off-grid or islanded setups, you have like real lead times on generator builds or turbine builds, right? Like you can get a Cat 3520 right now and pay for it, but you're not going to get it for 9 or 10 months. And so there's some problems like all around it, like getting the physical infrastructure required to generate electricity off-grid. And a lot of people just don't know about them. And so it's complicated. I think we end up with a good mix though, right? Like over the next year and a half, while the larger facilities come online and, you know, really start to energize some of these subs, there's a great opportunity for the elastic expansion of like smaller mining facilities that can ROI hardware very cheaply, like within that year. And then after that, I think difficulty and hash rate just kind of trend up and up and up, and it's always a race to the bottom. That's it. It's a race to the bottom on your all-in electricity costs, on your operating expenses outside of your electricity costs, and then how efficiently you can run the machines. So I think we get a mix of both over the next year, and then a lot of it's going to be dominated by these big builds, but jurisdictionally, you got a ton of risk if you're doing it anywhere other than Texas. Like New York Zone D's got great pricing, right? That North ISO, great pricing. But who's going to stand up a big facility in New York right now?
Exactly. Nobody.
Right. And so a lot of things to consider.
I'm super bullish on Texas too. I think you know, if things start hitting the fan in the US, there's no better place to be. Maybe, you know, Wyoming, Montana out there too. But
Zach and I were debating that yesterday. Yeah, where do you want to be if things really hit the fan? And Zach's like, I want to be in Austin. I said, do you want to be in a major city? And yeah, I don't think Texas, he's thought it through enough, but it's all good.
Texas forever. I kind of want to pick up what Austin was just touching on there for both Bobby and Austin, because it's pretty fascinating in my mind to watch. You know, about a year ago, everyone was talking about the main pain point in mining being machine supply. Everyone wanted machines. There weren't enough to go around in most part. You know, secondary markets for machines were red hot. And now sort of the entire market is flip-flopped, where like there's a ton of machines. We talked about this earlier in this conversation. A lot in storage, but there's definitely no shortage of ASICs anymore. The shortages are very much elsewhere. And I kind of want to break down a little bit, if you guys can share, like some of the lead times exactly you're seeing, like where the main pain points are in terms of building out new infrastructure, equipping all the electrical outfitting that needs to be done to actually, you know, have a facility prepared to receive and install ASICs. I mean, right now you try and buy a couch or a fridge, you're looking at least an 8-month lead time for basic stuff like that. And the lead times for some of this infrastructure build out that is needed for a mining facility, I would guess is at least in that time range. I don't know, what sort of delays, lead times are you guys seeing for some of this stuff? Bob, first to you, and then hand it back to Austin.
Yeah. So we'll start with the ASICs themselves. Obviously it depends on what you want to buy, but I mean, we'll just say you're well into next year at this point for any material purchase. Right. And, depending on, there's some unannounced stuff that's coming, that obviously I can't talk about, but I have some knowledge of, and you know, that stuff's in the early second half of next year. But you know, we can start placing orders for some of that now. You know, kind of the stuff that's in the market today, though, even just kind of a S19 class sort of thing, you know, we're well into Q1, for any material order. We'll fill in little gaps here and there, you know, on spot market stuff. We talked about that before. You know, Austin will probably be better to discuss some of the other stuff, because we don't build containers. We buy them, but you know, our typical suppliers, you know, we're into early next year just for a container itself. And even at that, like one of the ones that we're having built right now, the supplier's missing some of his dates because of some of the little pieces in the electrical infrastructure that just aren't there, and stuff stuck on boats, stumps, you know, you know, so I mean, if even a very small project, you know, a half a megawatt, a megawatt kind of project, you know, it would probably be miraculous to put that together in 6 months at this point.
Miracle in 6 months. That's pretty incredible. Just in terms of the delays we're looking at. I know I've had a couple of chats with Steve Barber, who also builds things similar to what you guys are working on, Austin. And he said, yeah, like he's, you know, some of his suppliers are just like, we don't have these parts right now. What sort of lead times are you looking at, or are you hearing and seeing for, you know, basic electrical stuff and hardware that you need to build out a farm?
Yeah. So a bunch of stuff, right? Like I alluded to earlier, kind of our larger distribution items, panels, switchboards, those got pushed from like 21 day standard lead time, like 4 weeks, to now like 35 days. And so not a huge thing. And it's not a material component issue. It's a labor issue. So like you still have some states, and then the federal government still has some unemployment subsidies for these folks who simply don't want to go back to work. And so you can't hire good labor to actually do the physical labor to put these things together, palletize them, and ship them, right? For minor cables, so like we, you know, have custom orders with large manufacturers of minor cables. The order that I placed 17 weeks ago, that was 8-week ARO, just showed up last week. Right. And so, and like I had to threaten him. I was like, dude, I'm going to cancel this whole order. It's like $100,000 order. I'm going to cancel the whole thing unless it shows up. And then magically it got shipped like the next week after that. Right. And so we started bringing a lot of stuff in house, just because I can't continue to like rely on other people for things that we could build ourselves, even at a little bit of a higher cost, and get them out the door, not in 6 months, but in 8 to 10 weeks. And so for the most part, it is just the labor to actually physically build these things, which we have here. It's just sourcing materials. We've had to get a little bit creative with some of the copper wire, like even little things like ferrules, like the ferrule ends that go on minor cables, or even like our big landings. Those things are hard to find. And I'm just like, I call, like, we have a custom metal shop that does a lot of work for us. And I called him the other day and I was like, hey, can you build this? He was like, I don't know. Like, bring me one. I'll see. Because our normal suppliers just don't have them. And so we've gotten pretty creative. But yeah, lead times and supply chains, like I said earlier, just borked out of control. And if you're doing, like, we've got, I don't know, I have like a 30 or 40 container backlog at this point that'll roll out over the next couple of months. And I've got everything on order, but whether or not it shows up on time is the question.
For sure. Yeah, I think we see like a bunch of these public miners, you know, placing huge orders, and they love to announce them for ASICs and stuff. The whole question we're talking about this afternoon is like, where are they going to put them? And, you know, they're not getting all the ASICs at once, obviously, but it's cool to announce you bought, you know, 50,000 ASICs, but finding plugs for those computers is a completely different situation. And from what you guys are saying, the lead times there are sort of aligning perfectly with like what we just talked about in terms of hash rate recovery predictions, you know, next July, next October, November, or something like that. And then, you know, I agree 100% with what Austin said a bit ago. Like, once we reach that like tipping point or breaking point or threshold, whatever you want to call it, there's going to be an explosion. Like, everything's going to come back online. People are like, a lot of these bottlenecks are going to be worked out, ironed out. And, you know, hopefully at that point we see some great price action to accompany the hash rate action too. But there is definitely the bottleneck is going to burst at some point, and it's just going to be an avalanche of new hash power coming online. It'll be fun to watch, but until then, you know, lots of pain points like you guys are describing.
Yeah, one little anecdote people might enjoy here is I mentioned we have a new facility, small facility coming online in South Carolina, and we had a couple parts not come through at the last minute, and so I had parts of my team banging around junkyards in South Carolina buying wire, and we found a panel, but we literally bought stuff in a junkyard yesterday just to get this thing up and going. So, you know, that's what we resorted. Thank God we found it, but we found what we needed, but yeah, that's where we are.
Yeah. Bob, follow up on that. Actually, I'm wondering if there's like a silver lining to any of this, because we've seen it in other places where companies like Bitcoin mining firms are having to vertically integrate everything right now because they have to figure out how to get all these systems up and going and rely on themselves. So do you think that's going to lead to like a more robust industry in 5 years from now? Or is it really just right now, because of supply chain issues, this is only a momentary problem, and a year or two from now, firms are going to go back to the way they've been doing business before, which is they're just like focusing on one aspect of their operation?
It's a great question. You know, 5 years out is a ways. You know, I will say that what we've looked at in the short to medium term is that we're going to have to be more vertically integrated. So I can answer that in the short to medium term. And we have looked at producing our own containers. And we would do it for ourselves. By the way, we're not in the market really of selling to other people, but saying, yeah, hey, we may have to take this on ourselves, because as I said, at least we're in control. At least we know what's happening. You know, I don't want to say too much, but as you can tell from my shirt, I was down in El Salvador. And like, one of the things I've looked at is like, hey, if I expand my footprint outside the US, do I have to bring some of those vertical capabilities into these other areas of the world? You know, that's something that I'm bantering about right now is should I build containers in El Salvador, for instance?
Those are for sure
processes I had.
Yeah, no, that's something I want to touch on, actually, because we've talked about, you know, you guys both work at companies that are deploying small to mid-scale operations all over the place. And totally okay if you're not, if you don't want to talk about exactly where these deployments are. But I am just curious to know sort of your thought process, or like regions you would not consider, or if you're open to power anywhere, basically inside, outside the US, no matter where it is, like where are you looking actively now, like given everything that's going on, given these longer lead times, given the glut of ASICs, given everyone's trying to plug in machines that were taken online and new machines they ordered, like your day to day, where are you looking to, you know, these little operations around the world, where are you looking to set these up? What's your, you know, evaluation analysis process in terms of where you're going to deploy next? Austin, I'll hand it to you and then back to Bob.
Yes. Yeah, so we are, we're Great American Mining, right? At the end of the day, like we don't have any plans right now to expand outside of the United States or maybe even Canada on like a smaller scale jurisdictionally. I weigh risk similar to like how some of the oil and gas companies who've tried to operate past our southern border have like run into issues where you show up one day with equipment, you set up a workover rig or drilling rig, and, like you show up the next week and the whole thing's gone and chopped up, right? And so I think within the United States, it gives investors or any type of institutional capital a pretty decent security in terms of their investment. Like what kind of money is pouring into a company and where is it going, in addition to like some of the property laws here that are really strong. And, you know, further kind of down that rabbit hole, when you look at different jurisdictions within the United States, like I'll never deploy in Washington State, right? I saw what happened in Washington State in 2017, where a bunch of the PUDs just went in and like unilaterally raised rates on these PPAs. Once you do it once, like I'll never deploy there again. Same thing with like New York State. I'll never plug anything into New York State. Texas is fantastic. North Dakota is fantastic. Oklahoma is fantastic. Pennsylvania's growing on me a little bit. Ohio's fantastic. Like all the jurisdictions where you know that you have people who, number one, want to make money. Number two, are entrepreneurial enough to have the, I guess you'd call it political capital, to where they're not going to throw something like totally out the window just because of some like hysterical climate headlines. Right. And so jurisdiction, big one. Number two, like power costs. So I kind of like bang this drum internally at Great American Mining all the time. Like guys, like we are, you know, we're converting flare gas, but we can't be like held to this narrative because I'm totally unbiased about what the energy input is. All I care about is price. That is it.
For sure.
And I think that the miner who is tied to a narrative over a long enough time and doesn't care as much about the price, like doesn't end up being a miner over a long enough timeline, because you're going to get pushed out of a market that's entirely zero sum. And so, yeah, price of power, and that's like all in. So there's a lot of stuff like off grid where you have to pay mineral rights owners, royalties on the gas. Like there's a lot that goes into that calculation. But yeah, jurisdiction, power price, pretty much it. Like weather, I don't really care about. There's always ways to like Alex Epstein says, climate mastery. Like we can master any climate. We're being pretty competitive in terms of how we're using energy. To say that it's too hot in West Texas to run air cooled mines, like there's a way to figure that out if the power's cheap enough. And so sure. Yeah, weather, jurisdiction, power price, that's it.
Yeah, it's just cool. Jump in there really quick. The points you're making are interesting to see play out right now. The Pennsylvania one, especially like Zach and I went to college in Pennsylvania together, and there's just loads of old power plants sitting around that state, just doing absolutely nothing because it's all like Rust Belt infrastructure that has been collapsing. And now people are picking up the phone. They own these old power stations and they want to put Bitcoin miners in them, even though they haven't been running for 20 plus years. So yeah, it's really interesting to see like all that old infra coming back online through Bitcoin mining.
Yeah, I appreciated the Ohio and PA shout out too. I think we talk about mining in North America. it's pretty much Texas and Wyoming that take center stage there, but you have it scattered all over. Bob, we have a couple people in the chat asking if you're going to start deploying machines to volcano powered farms in El Salvador there. Same question to you, like where are you looking at in terms of where you would deploy? I guess if there are any areas similar to what Austin mentioned, where you're like, we're never going to plug anything in there again. And if so, like what's on that shit list for you? Just your thought process in general for deployments and location.
Got it. Well, I'll answer the question first. I am open to it. So the answer is I am open to the volcano powered stuff. It's not quite ready yet. But it's also not that far away. So it will happen. Frankly, it meets my criteria. So I'm not saying I'm doing it or not doing it. We're not quite there, but jurisdictionally, can't find a government that supports us better than El Salvador, right? In what we're doing. I mentioned before, I like boutique mining, as does Austin, but I also like off-grid boutique mining even better. I'm not 100% opposed to the right grid solution. We have a little bit on grid right now, but I really prefer off-grid. I'm in control. So that's another piece for me. Friendly jurisdiction. But even with that, if I can control it and be off grid, I like it, because I think as regulation comes in, it's probably not going to typically be in the form of bans. I think it's going to be in the form of taxation or some sort of charge. And I think they'll try to leverage the grid to do that. So I think even in a less friendly place, you might still be okay if you're off grid. Places I hate. I hate the entire West Coast for mining. I hate Oregon, California, and Washington. I won't do a thing there. No chance. I won't do Illinois. I won't do New York. Won't do Massachusetts. Not saying there are even opportunities in some of these places, but they're off the list. Like don't even call me. I don't need to talk to you. So, those are off the list. Certainly I like Texas. I live in Florida, by the way. I'm trying to see what we can do down here. And I know there are initiatives. I don't have anything yet, but I would, again, it kind of ticks the boxes. I'm not afraid of the heat like Austin. I think we can handle all those sort of things. I'm in South Dakota, Nebraska, that region up through North Dakota, I'm completely open to. I like all those places. And I'm fine with Appalachia. So the area that you're talking about, the Ohio, Pennsylvania, Southern, Northern West Virginia, all that sort of area. There's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of opportunities in those areas. Outside the U.S., El Salvador obviously is interesting. The piece that has to be worked on there, frankly, is cost. The cost structure is not there right now. And then until there's some stuff to be worked out, and I'm trying. There are other countries in that region that have a lot of stranded energy. So, we'll see what happens. Interestingly, I'm not opposed to it, but I still don't know how to quite make wind and solar. So there's a lot of focus. Like there's some massive solar farms in El Salvador. Very, very interesting. But, how do you handle the other 12 hours of the day is a big issue. And the economics, I'm not quite sure, can add up. I've looked, we've had members of our team over in places like Georgia before, and Kazakhstan. I'm not quite there yet. I feel it's, you can go there, you can get some good costs, but to me, there's too much risk of something happening, your equipment being nationalized or seized or something like that. It's just too risky. So.
No, that makes perfect sense. We have a couple people in the chat pointing out that yours and Austin's shit lists are basically all blue states. Not to you know, politicize it too much, but red states good, blue states bad, maybe for mining. Kind of a funny breakdown there.
Yeah, it's not a political statement necessarily.
No, yeah, just, I know.
It's, but it is that way because I mean, let's just be real. Like, hey, if you're in a state where, and by the way, it's when you say jurisdictional, there's the legal aspect, and then there's like, hey, are you welcome here? Are you welcome in the community? Are you,
yeah,
are your workers going to be there? Are, you know, all, so it's not just the legal aspect. It's like, hey, you know, do you want to go where you're invited to the party and you're welcome? Or do you want to go where you're, you know, the uninvited guest that nobody really wants there, even if legally you could be there?
Cold shoulder. Yeah, for sure. Nobody wants a cold shoulder. Interesting breakdown from both you guys. I appreciate that. And you mentioned Florida, Bob, briefly. I know Miami's mayor, super, I mean, he's talked about it a lot. Haven't seen too many like concrete steps taken to attract miners there. And yeah, Florida Power isn't the cheapest in the U.S., but if we see this price continue to go up, you know, people absolutely will plug in machines at Florida Power costs. It's interesting you mentioned solar too. We had a full live stream about that a couple weeks ago, and what we basically settled on in terms of economics is you're pretty much going to be intermittent mining with renewables if that's what you choose to power your facility or your ASICs with. I think there's attractive options for solar farms to expand into mining on the side. In terms of miners, you know, seeking out solar power, it maybe not won't work as well in that direction. But you use immersion, overclock your ASICs a little bit, and set up a good intermittent system. It may wear down the lifetime of the machines a bit, but you can make it work if you're. There's probably a lot easier ways to get cheap power, but if you're set on solar, there are definitely strategies to make it work. We're coming up on close to time here. One thing we haven't really talked about the price too much, but I do want to mention it. And since it's the relationship with price and hash rate is obviously pretty key. And I want to know your opinions on basically the current relationship, because we've sort of seen hash rate, or we are seeing hash rate and price, decoupled isn't the best word, but the relationship is definitely in a different position than it's almost ever been. There's clearly buying activity from Bitcoin on the market. We've seen the price rebound a good bit. Hash prices soaring as a result, but you know, difficulty still pretty low. Hash price or hash rate is recovering a little bit. What do you guys make of, like, we don't have to get, I don't want anything too like technical in terms of market analysis, but when you're looking at price, as we all do with some regularity, like how are you thinking about it in terms of impacting mining and the relationship between like institutional investors, retail investors? They don't give a shit about hash rate necessarily. They just want to own Bitcoin and they are buying it. How do you think about, you know, those two relationships, buyers wanting Bitcoin and miners trying to find rack space to plug in their machines, and when, you know, when hash rate is going to catch up to where the price is starting to look like it's heading right now? Maybe hand it back to you, Bob, and then Austin. How do you think about price and hash rate?
I actually wrote an article on this one too. So anybody that finds my other article, you'll see this one. I think it's they're broken for quite a while. And that there may be some periods of positive correlation. In other words, you know, price going, in other words, hash is going to go up no matter what. Okay. And it's going to go up for the next like 18 months, regardless. And it can't go any faster. We've already, you know, the pedal is to the metal. Hash rate's going to go up at the rate it can go up, regardless of price. If price goes down, because of the situation, we have so much insulation right now. You know, it'd have to drop probably by, you know, 50% from current levels for, I think, anybody to start saying, hey, maybe I better turn it off. Right. So I think it's broken. And eventually, probably post the halving, and the deployment of this new infrastructure, you'll see them realign, but it's broken. So if you're a trader, which I'm not, but if you're a trader and you've traded patterns of hash and price and looked for gaps, and I've talked to some technical guys that do that, find something else to trade on, because you're going to get wrecked. So
interesting. Broken. I feel bad we didn't pull up your other article. I haven't read that one yet, but I pretty much agree with all of that there. I don't know, Austin, same question to you. Relationship between hash rate and Bitcoin price. How do you think about it now?
Yeah, I mean, historically, hash rate follows Bitcoin price, always has, probably always will to some extent. It just really depends on like the size of the operation that you're putting together, when it starts to cash flow, what your financial risk model looks like. I mean, there's a million variables that go into here, right? Like, you've got, even if you look back at the 2018 bottom, I think break even was 4.4 cents a kilowatt hour. And so taking that number, moving it forward, adjusting for inflation, like, who knows what the new break even like bottom is for the next bear market. It could be 6 cents or 6.5 cents, if like inflation adjusted from the last one. And so I think ultimately, you know, when it's profitable to mine, people are going to plug in miners. When it's not profitable to mine, people are going to unplug miners. And like, the third dynamic variable there is how the difficulty adjusts in those periods. And so right now, I look at, and I mean, there's a whole nother monkey wrench that got thrown into this equation, where you have like publicly traded miners that can access public capital markets. And so they aren't as sensitive to these difficulty and hash rate and Bitcoin price adjustments. They're more sensitive to like why do the big miners make announcements on like their purchase of big tranches, 30,000 machines, right? Because it material affects their current share price. If the share price goes up just from an announcement, and that's basically reflecting future cash flow from that operation, assuming they get racked and lit, then that's a whole different variable that goes into, you know, the relationship between hash and like Bitcoin price now. And so I don't know. I think it's broken like medium term. I agree with Bob, but at the same time, there's a bunch of other variables that have been added in here.
For sure.
Yeah, totally. Bob, awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it. It's great having you guys on.
We've had a ton of fun. Appreciate it. For everyone who's watching, Bob and Austin are both on Twitter. They're great follows. Austin does a little bit of shit posting, but neither of them do too much. We'll have to push them more in that direction. But beyond
the GM account does enough, right? Is that who's running that one? Who's behind the screen?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say who's running that account.
I know who it is. Don't worry.
We'll keep it. It's not me.
It's not me. It's not Marty. It's not Todd. So.
Oh, it's definitely Marty.
Anyway, give them all a follow. Beyond the shit posting, they're both super insightful. Check out Bob's articles. GAM also has a great podcast covering all things Bitcoin and mining. And definitely like, follow, subscribe. The live stream here, we're back every week, every Wednesday and Friday, with more cool guests like Bob and Austin. It's both of you, and also to Will. Thanks for coming on the show. It's been a lot of fun and super insightful for me. I know from the chat, our listeners and viewers have enjoyed it also. So thank you both for taking time on a Friday. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.